You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this week's show continues our month of episodes looking at war comics. Later in this episode, in another recording from the Imperial War Museum's Comics and Conflicts Conference that took place last month, cultural historians Roger Sabin and Martin Baker are giving a presentation about the depiction of the Iraq War and post-traumatic stress disorder in the US comic strip Doonesbury. Before that, you'll hear a couple of interviews I recorded at the National Army Museum in Chelsea at the opening of their new exhibition, Draw Your Weapons, The Art of Commando Comics. First up, I'm talking to curator Robert Fleming, and then later to the current Commando editor Callum Laird and his predecessor George Lowe, who are talking about the history of the comic. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
Robert Fleming, curator of Draw Your Weapons at the National Army Museum. This exhibition is something a bit different for the National Army Museum in terms of, I guess, dealing with the ways that popular culture depicts war and conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. I was trying to look at ways that the British Army was portrayed through popular culture. And in particular, I think comic art is something a little bit different. It's something probably not in keeping with the sort of art that we normally display in the museum. Mm. And obviously, I think Commando is probably the most iconic war comic. So yeah. We obviously wanted to sort of explore the way that they depict the British Army. Yeah. Mm.
Well, certainly the most ubiquitous, nearly 4,500 issues in 50 years. So I think there's hardly anyone in the British Isles that hasn't seen a copy at some point.
And the Commonwealth. I mean, I'm from Australia, and I grew up out in Australia reading it as well. So it was just as popular out there as here. But yeah, obviously, 4,500 issues, it's one of the most prolific comics in the entire world. Mm. Batman and Superman haven't done that many. So it's just, I think, part of British culture, particularly in the post-war era. The comic, as you say, most young lads at some point will have picked up a copy and had a look through it. So I think everyone sort of recognises the name, if not the sort of iconic cover art. And that's what I was trying to explore with this exhibition. The cover art on the newsstand really catches your eye and makes you want to pick it up and find out what it's about. Mm.
Coming across the comic, perhaps, in your formative years and then your desire to become a curator at the National Army Museum, did they dovetail at any point before this exhibition that's open today?
Not at all, really. I think it was something that I got into as a sort of 10, 12-year-old and then had put away. So it's actually sort of going back to that in a way. I'm really glad to have had the opportunity to do this because it's something, as I say, it's quite different. But I don't think there was any sort of specific draw to it other than the aspects of popular culture and the iconic cover art itself. Mm. I think, you know, obviously it's the 50th anniversary this year, so it was a great opportunity for us to do a collaboration with the publishers. Mm.
And I guess the kind of art that one might normally see in the National Army Museum are paintings that have been commissioned for propaganda purposes, to depict wartime conflicts for educational purposes, and they're obviously highly rendered oil paintings and other media that are designed to stand the test of time. Something like Commando that's printed on cheap paper, that comes out once a week, that has very kind of stylized, gritty black and white art. Again, that kind of juxtaposition between the normal art you show and this more sort of ephemeral art, I guess, brings a different aesthetic to the exhibition that you might, compared to ones you might normally find here.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we do have, in our art gallery, we have some of the finest examples of British battle painting from throughout history, going back to the Civil War and that sort of period. And obviously, this is something slightly different. It was originally, you know, intended to be slightly disposable in a way. It was just for the purpose of building the cover. But obviously, the editors, Callum Laird and George Lowe, and the earlier editors, saw a value in retaining it. And as you can see from the artwork that's on display here, I mean, it's stylized, it's not fine art, but it's done in an incredibly accurate way. They well researched the uniforms and the weapons and the equipment. The historical settings are all very accurate and vibrant, powerful colours. It makes really dynamic and attention-grabbing art.
Mm. Because I guess one thing that comics can portray that you don't get from war photography or even cinematic representations of war is that they have that kind of down-to-earth grittiness that depict soldiers in conflict from angles and in situations that you might not see in other media. And then that brings it very much to the fore for readers who want to find out about those situations, particularly younger readers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a lot of young people, going back to what we were saying before about the sort of younger lads in the British Isles and the Commonwealth, it was probably one of the first introductions to British military history that they had, or at least Second World War history. And it's done in a way which, you know, it's probably not as in-depth as more serious history, but because of the historical accuracy, it's giving them a background and an understanding. And the artwork does have an emotive element, so it's sort of not just teaching about military history, but you're also learning about soldiers' experience of war, the confrontations that they face. Sometimes there aren't always black and white decisions in a conflict situation. There are grey areas, you know, do you leave a companion behind to save someone else or what have you? And then once you've made a mistake, how you go about seeking redemption, and those sorts of issues are dealt with in Commando.
Mm. And I suppose within the pantheon of war comics, Commando is one that actually complements the National Army Museum more than any other, because your collection goes considerably further into the past than, say, the Imperial War Museum's collection. And as Commando also goes back to conflicts of the 19th century and then right up to the present day, it seems like a very good fit.
Yeah, that's right. Our collection, our art collection, obviously does go back to the Napoleonic era, before the Civil War and earlier. And Commando do exactly the same. I think probably the bulk of their work is Second World War. It's a very popular topic, as it is in military history in general. But, yeah, as you say, I think they do align in the sort of stories that both institutions really tell. Yeah.
When it came to curating the exhibition itself, presumably you met up with the editor of the magazine and thought about which stories were the best ones to represent the history of the publication and the best ones that would look good on the walls of the exhibition space.
Well, I certainly did consult with him, but actually they were quite willing to give me carte blanche. So
right, okay.
if there's any criticism to be levelled, it's probably in my direction. But I think, you know, Commando's got such a rich background of different stories, different artists, different themes. It was quite easy for me, really, to be able to find some quite iconic artwork and iconic stories to display here. And as you can see, you know, you've got a wide variety of different styles. You have some quite stylized, some very realistic images. So, you know, there's such a wonderful palette. There's over 3,500 original artworks, so it was more difficult picking which ones not to include than which ones were really standout images to use.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. With, you know, over 3,500 issues to choose from, how did you even begin that process? I mean, I know that on their website, for example, they have a search engine where you can look for titles based on whether they're war, land, sea or air conflicts, whether they're Second World War, First World War, and so on. Did you start off thinking that you wanted to represent different conflicts in particular?
It was a bit of a headache, I have to say. I found a fan site which had every single cover listed and printed the entire 3,500 off, which ran to like 60-odd pages. And the first place to start, obviously, was excluding Navy and Air Force images, because we don't deal with that in the museum, so it's all Army.
Okay.
Then from that, I think you touched on trying to get a wide variety of the conflicts, the different eras. We have some 19th century settings, we have Second World War, and we have more recent, I think there's a sort of Royal Marines raiding an oil rig that's been taken over by terrorists and things like that. So it does cover the entire period of history. I've also tried to get as many of the different artists, or a different palette of the different artists, the different styles, the different colours. So it was more about just trying to sort of showcase the wide variety of topics and things that Commando deals with.
I don't know if you've kept an eye on, say, the popularity of war comics over recent years outside of working in the museum, but it seems until about 5 years ago, war comics had almost vanished, you know, from news shelves, apart from the continuing presence of Commando. And then in the last couple of years, there's been a real resurgence, particularly the collections of war comics, which I guess is a mixture of parents now remembering the stories they read as a kid and wanting to own them in bookshop format, and also perhaps new readers coming to it not knowing that Britain had a rich history of war comics?
Yeah, well, I think definitely that's the case. I think the readership of Commando, for instance, really peaked in the early 80s. And I think that the sort of petering off with that had a lot to do with new competition from Saturday morning cartoons, from the rise of video games in popularity, and just the new range of media that's available. Now we have obviously films, television, Sky, Xbox and PlayStation, Call of Duty obviously is an area where a lot of young children learn about the Second World War now instead of comics. But I think the resurgence actually is quite a really an interesting thing. Perhaps it's children discovering their parents' collections and things like that. You know, I know I still have somewhere in my parents' house back home, I've still got a box of the old Commandos. So they're obviously lurking in attics to be discovered. But I think also the impact of foreign comics has sort of triggered a resurgence as well. Obviously, you've seen things like Japanese manga coming in and those sort of things, which have become very popular. And then from that, I think, as you say, probably people have discovered that actually Britain has its own indigenous comic industry, which used to be once an enormous thing. I think Callum, the editor, mentioned to me they sold over 750,000 copies in 1 month in the 80s. So that's, you know, obviously it used to be an enormous part of popular culture. And I think there is still a very strong interest and element in that.
Cool. Thank you very much. I'm talking to George Lowe, editor of Commando to 2007, and Callum Laird, the current editor of the comic. We're standing in the exhibition Draw Your Weapons at the National Army Museum. Commando was created as a kind of ephemeral kids' comic that was distributed in newsagents and presumably with its amazing frequency designed to be kind of like thrown away after being enjoyed. Seeing an exhibition like this, which celebrates the comic in a more permanent way and actually has an exhibition of the original artwork from the comics in a format that, you know, really celebrates the artistry that went into it, I guess for you guys must be, you know, very encouraging that a national institution has taken notice of the comic in this way.
Yes, we were quite surprised, because for an awful long time our reading public kept Commando going, but very few people took interest apart from that. And it's really nice to come here to see so many fine illustrations displayed extremely well, and quite a bit of good information relayed about them as well.
And the comic itself is now celebrating its 50th year of publication, and you were serving editor for most of those years. Did you think when you started off on the title that it would become your career?
No. There was always the option to move to other publications, but every time the chance came up, I was dragged back to Commando, so I was stuck with it, but I didn't complain.
The art that we have on the walls is probably a surprise for people who anyone knows the comic, in that the original artwork is about A3 size and so must have been reduced to about a quarter of the original content. And seeing the artistry that's involved in creating these images, I guess it shows that as an editor, you were commissioning artists to do pieces that could be considered fine art as well as just the cover of a weekly comic.
We always thought that. We were always very aware that the cover artists, especially the likes of Ian Kennedy, British artist, a few of the foreign artists, Longeron, Benalva, Jose Maria Jorge and so on, it was a very, very high standard, and any of them could have stood alone as an illustration framed on the wall, which is exactly what's been done here. And that shows the truth behind that, you know?
And the art generally, it looks like acrylics and watercolours, but the most surprising piece in terms of the materials that went into it is a framed picture we have on the I can see Callum laughing because he knows where I'm going with this, is a picture we have on the wall here called Dress to Kill, where the artist has actually included real sand in the paint that's applied to the page. Did you encourage the artist to use kind of experimental materials like this, or was it actually a surprise when this arrived in the studio?
This one was quite a surprise. I think he was a Spanish artist, Penalva, and I suspect that he was maybe putting some rough cast on his garden shed and thought, well, this will make the hut look very realistic, and put it on. And as I've often said, when we took the illustration out of the tube, there was enough of the little bits and pieces at the bottom to cover up a hole in any wall.
Also included in the exhibition is the original artwork from the very first issue of Commando. So this suggests that D.C. Thompson actually kept and stored the original artwork, or at least the artist did, for the long term. Was that something that you encouraged as editor, that actually, because it was great artwork, it should be stored with reverence?
The first editor, Charles Jekley, known as Chick, had always wanted to be an artist.
Okay.
So he had a great respect for the artwork and worked on my artists. So we were imbued by the sense that here was something precious, something we had to look after. And it was relatively easy to do because the book was 63 pages. It would fit easily into an envelope and be stored. The covers could be quite easily stored within the office itself, which is the reason that so many of them, in fact, almost all of them, have survived. We didn't think at the time that we would be still going after 50 years. And they weren't kept at the beginning with any other thought in mind that we would just keep them safely. But then when we started reprinting them, that proved to be a very wise decision indeed, because we could virtually lift them off the shelf and use them again.
And Callum, you took over as editor in 2007. The comic had been going for over 45 years. It was approaching its 50th anniversary and obviously had a great legacy that had been built up over the years. Was that quite a daunting thing to step into the shoes of?
In some respects, yes. I mean, I see myself more as a custodian than anything else. But I've actually worked on Commando as a junior sub-editor and so forth since 1981. Although, unlike George, I managed to escape several times, but I was always dragged back by the guards with the dogs, but sometimes after a number of years. It was daunting, and I mean, I've got a working relationship with George, obviously, but he's a good mate as well. And I think there were a couple of times, maybe 6 months in, I phoned him up and said, "George, I really don't know if I'm doing the right thing here." And he said, it was exactly the same when he took over. You go in with great confidence, you've got great plans, and you're doing this, doing that, and doing the next thing, and you really, in about 6 months in, you suddenly think, am I doing the right thing here? Is this working? And you've got figures coming in and feedback and so on, but you really, daunting, definitely, definitely, because it's a national institution.
Yeah.
It's taken the National Art Museum 50 years to realise that, but you know, they are a museum, we'll let them away with that.
Because the comic has such a great following and a great love for both parents and younger audiences alike, does it mean you have a massive slush pile of artists and writers desperate to get into the pages of the comic?
We do. We're constantly getting, I'm constantly getting now, authors pitching, artists trying to get work. There is a limited amount of work. We've got a roster of artists who we supply. Maybe somebody comes along just at the right place at the right time as an artist, and they do get in. But it's a lot of people, national institution, or I'd like to draw for that. That would be, or I'd like to write for that. So there's still a lot of interest in actually contributing to Commando. Yeah.
Because there was a little bit of attention on the internet a few months ago that comic book journalist Matt Badham had a story printed in Commando. So I guess these kind of peaks in terms of cultural interest in the comic, that and then now this exhibition, is the sort of thing that maybe brings new readers to the title, not to mention George's various collections of reprint volumes that are in bookshops.
Yes, I mean, the reprint volumes have been a superb vehicle for reawakening interest, latent interest in the title, because with our small size, very easily overlooked on a bookshelf in a newsagent. So these jumbo books, people realised Commando, they saw the title, Commando's still there, then realised we were still coming out fortnightly. So I mean, and something like Matt's story piqued an interest on the internet, because he's well known for his commentaries on comics. So yes, there's all sorts of things like that go on. It's all sorts of reasons for it to be suddenly pop up in the national interest. Yeah.
The inclusion of the artwork from the comic in the National Army Museum shows that it's not just an ephemeral title, but something that has gathered respect for the research that goes on in the pages. Is that something that you have to almost train new writers and artists in? Or because of the reputation of the comic, is that something they come to you having already started doing?
Well, one of the reasons why Commando is structured the way it is, in that a scriptwriter supplies a script. Mm. It then comes into the editorial office before it goes to the illustrator. Okay. There isn't a communication directly between the two, and that's so that, with the benefit of our expertise in the office, such as it is, we can actually tweak any technical details within the stories so that they are right, or as near right as we can get them. And our illustrators know what it is they have to illustrate, because we've told them. We've told them we've specified the particular rifle, the uniform, the vehicle, or whatever. And we've done that since the beginning. And that's why there is the accuracy, because you do not rely on one author to get it right, because it's not fair. He's not a historian. We are amateur military historians. We've got a huge reference library that we can call on, so we can get it right. So that's part of it. That's part of the formula.
Is it difficult getting the comic out there to new readers these days, with the pressures that I guess that there are in newsagents during a recession to put the flashiest titles on display, while a sort of a quieter, smaller comic like Commando, which I remember when I was a kid, had its own unique little spinner rack in newsagents, is now perhaps harder to find in the crowded shelves of your high street?
It is. The marketing of comics magazines has changed. There are an awful lot more supermarkets now. That's where people get their comics, they get their magazines, they get their newspapers. We're not carried by any of the supermarkets. Our main carrier is W. H. Smith. Yes, it's small, and modern shelving doesn't help us, because the sort of barrier across the front is maybe 2 inches, 3 inches high. Covers up half our covers. We're aware of this, which is why the Commando logo is always so colourful as we can. And if we can get an explosion up near the top of the cover, that helps. It is difficult. It's a much more crowded marketplace than it was from the point of view of other comics, other magazines. But there's also internet, video, games and so on. So it's a very competitive market. In 1982, Commando shifted 750,000 copies in a month. Nobody does that now. And we don't expect to. But we've launched our app, so you can actually download it onto your iPhone or your iPad, and you can read it on the train coming in to work at Canary Wharf or whatever, and nobody realises you're reading a comic. It's funny, they think, oh, he's probably reading Proust on his Kindle. No, he's reading Commando. So that's another way that we're moving forward in the 50th year, to look forward to another 50 years, as distinct from this exhibition, which is very much a retrospective, and rightly so. But we are looking forward to different means of communicating with new readers, and different media of supplying what they want to them.
Well, and the irony being that the small size of the comic might make it difficult to spot in modern newsagents, but for electronic devices like the iPad and the iPhone, it's an ideal size for reading on a screen, because you don't have to shrink down the artwork to fit the image that you're looking at.
Yeah, well, George mentioned the first editor, Charles Checkley. I'm sure he knew that iPad was going to be invented in 50 years, and he insisted on that size and that format. I've always thought that. George is nodding.
And then conversely, George, with your reprint volumes, they're actually a bit bigger than the original size. Was that a decision because of the need for bookshelves in shops to display a slightly larger product that maybe has a greater gravitas in reprint format?
I think it probably was, although the decision was Carlton's.
Okay.
They decided to do it that way, and we were very pleased to see it done that way, because the pages could actually stand to be enlarged quite a bit because of the amount of detail and fine art which was involved in them. And it made it a more telling, a more noticeable size, and that was good for us. Yeah?
And presumably the reprints help the continuing comic as much as the continuing comic helped the successor of the reprints.
We'd like to think so. It's very difficult to dig out the actual information which relates to it, but we would like to think that people have got the big bound volume and then have gone back to Commando, because we do know that from what we've heard. It's become, oh yes, I remember these, well, they're still on the go, I'll go and get them. And that is good, you know.
Cool. And so 50 years of Commando, the 4,500th issue coming out next summer, and an exhibition at the National Army Museum. You must be pleased at Punch that in this 50th anniversary year that the comic is still going and has so much attention.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, it's all fallen into place wonderfully. All the new stuff, all the retrospective stuff, this exhibition, which is fantastic, and it gives people the opportunity to see the artwork the way we see it, because up until now there hadn't really been an opportunity for anybody to see a commando cover other than as a commando cover, rather than a piece of artwork, which it obviously is. And we've been lucky, George, over his length of service, me since 1981, to be able to see these things as the artist originally intended. And it's not actually until you come in here you realise what a treat we've actually had compared to the reader. The reader's been slightly shortchanged, I feel, from the art point of view. Never from the book point of view, but obviously from the art point of view. They're getting a sort of almost a behind the scenes thing, because this is what we see on a weekly basis.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Not at all.
To find out more information about Commando Comics, please go to www.commandocomics.com, where there's information about the iPhone and iPad apps which allow you to download 4 issues for free before subscribing to the comic. The exhibition, Draw Your Weapons, is on at the National Army Museum until April 2012. The National Army Museum can be found in Chelsea near the Chelsea Barracks, and the 170 bus from Victoria stops just outside the front door of the museum, or if you prefer to walk from the nearest tube, then it's fairly close to Sloane Square. Next, here's Roger Sabin and Martin Baker's presentation from the Comics and Conflicts Festival at the Imperial War Museum, and they're talking about the depiction of the Iraq War and post-traumatic stress disorder in the US comic strip Doonesbury. Please note, the following presentation contains some strong language, and the opinion of Roger and Martin doesn't reflect my own or Resonance FM's.
We're doing this as a two-hander, so I'm going to hand over to Roger, who launches us, as it were.
Well, thank you very much. And we know it in this country because it runs in the Guardian newspaper, which is the leading liberal newspaper here. It's by Gary Trudeau, and it's an American strip, and it's been around a long time. It's been around in prototype form since 1968, and it was syndicated as Doonesbury for the first time in 1970. So it is a well-established strip. It's also online. A lot of people read it online. And, of course, in book collections as well. The book collections often make the lower reaches of the bestseller lists, especially in America. In the United States, it's much more famous than it is anywhere else. It's syndicated to 600 newspapers, and it is a sort of a cultural institution, in a way. It's a significant strip. Now, for most of its life, it has been a sort of a gag strip, really. And you can see Trudeau's sort of nice, blocky drawing style there. This is the cover from The Guardian's G2 section, which is a celebration of Doonesbury reaching its 40th year. This is an example of a strip from 1973. This is the Watergate era. It gives you a sort of a sense of the kind of satire that it was dealing with. Nice sort of flowing construction to the gags, you know, often with a punchline. It's ironic humour. It's actually pretty funny. I mean, a lot of people say to me that you have to know about American politics to get this strip. I don't think that's necessarily right. I think the gags are pretty understandable. It does star a cast of recurring characters, and they've developed over the years. And if you're not familiar with the characters, then there's a whole list of them online, and you can follow a sort of a, you've got mugshots of them online where you can work out who they are. So it also functions as a kind of soap opera as well, and that's important too. Also, you get images of politicians entering the strip on occasions, you know, presidents especially. So that's another aspect to it. Its relationship to war is what we're interested in today, obviously. And during Vietnam, it took an anti-war stance, but also with Grenada, Panama, the first Gulf War, and then recently with Iraq, when it's made its most powerful statement about the war. And it's at this point, when it talks about Iraq, that it becomes something else. It moves away from gag-telling, and it becomes a sort of a social commentary strip. And that's what we'll be talking about today. So what happened was that in 2004, Gary Trudeau sends one of his long-standing characters to Iraq as a soldier, and he gets badly injured. And this is that character recovering. So this is the focus of our talk today, is this storyline about the Iraq war and what happens to him. And it is a shocking moment, as we'll see. It is a really shocking piece of comic book art. So the story that Doonesbury tells about Iraq is about the horrors of war as told mainly through this one character, although there's plenty of supplementary humour as well. And in its own sort of quiet way, it's one of the most important war comics of recent times. The question we want to ask is, what kind of liberal politics are being expressed in Doonesbury in this period? And in trying to answer that, we'll be looking at three themes. Firstly, the notion of supporting the soldiers but not the war, which is a sort of a classic liberal position. Secondly, the persistence of Vietnam narratives. And thirdly, the role of post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's where I hand over to Martin for some background about the strip.
Thanks, Richard. Vietnam has cast a long pall over American politics and culture, there's no question about it, since the American defeat there and withdrawal in about 1974-75. And that pall is really crucial. So that when you get a cartoon like this, you're seeing, even though in 2001 George Bush Sr. declared after the first Gulf War, we finally kicked the Vietnam syndrome. In fact, of course, they hadn't. What is really important as the first background to thinking about Doonesbury is the recognition that at the time of the Vietnam War, the media were under intense scrutiny, wrongly so. But television was often blamed for America's defeat in Vietnam. Now, in fact, a man called Fred MacDonald did some remarkable research in a book called Television and the Red Menace, in which he demonstrates that right up until almost the end of the Vietnam War, television was totally on side with American politics, American support for the war, with the one thing that they actually showed what was going on. They did live coverage, as it were, of conflict. But that sense of the fear of being seen to be anti-American, being seen to be anti-war, afflicted both films and comic books, so that during the Vietnam War, a very, very few comic books dealt with it directly, and even fewer films. Once it was over, it became possible then, in retrospect, to deal with it in some detail. That's been different this time. And this is one of the things that really is very striking, that when we come forward to Iraq and Afghanistan, we see films in very, very large numbers, and I'm going to come back to one later on, because it's a really important insight into Doonesbury, actually. But also comic books and cartoon strips and editorial cartoons dealing in large, large numbers with the conflict. Here's, just very briefly, what I've come to call Hollywood's toxic genre, the number of films, in fact, 24 films in all, in a five-year period, coming out of the studios, coming out of the what's called Indiewood, the semi-independent studios, coming out of the independents themselves. Lots and lots of films, many of which went under the radar and became famous for failing more than anything else. Ending, of course, with two which did become very big, The Hurt Locker and Avatar. Avatar dealing with it indirectly at the distance of fantasy. The Hurt Locker dealing with it very, very directly. But there's a story we can't tell today. And finishing off with one which turned it just back into an action epic. So you have this large number of films addressing it. Now, we're not talking about films today, but it's worth saying one important thing about these films. They have a characteristic in common. Again and again in these films, there is work done to tell us this is contemporary, this is real. You see shots of politicians, you hear speeches, you see television coverage, etc. But at the same time, they fictionalize it. They insistently take away any sense that this is documentary. Why? Here, you need to see something that happened in Hollywood, because again, it forms an important background to Doonesbury. After Bill Clinton, Hollywood radicalized again. and a whole series of anti-war protests led by actors and directors and scriptwriters, etc., took place in Hollywood in the period 2000 to 2003. Then came the signal moment, which they thought was really going to turn it. It was this, Fahrenheit 9/11. Many, many people expected that this documentary was going to defeat Bush's election campaign, and it didn't. And one of the reasons it didn't was because people began to question the documentary form and Michael Moore's truthfulness and his ability to tell an honest story. But the other thing was a kickback around one particular idea which was caught in this poster which circulated on the internet. The soldier. Hey, Hollywood, sit down and pour yourselves a nice cup of shut the fuck up. Now, what's interesting about this poster, and I hope you're noticing it, is that the image of the soldier is a Second World War one. It's not a Vietnam one. It steps back past the period of controversy to pick on a time when soldiers were seen as evidently on the right side and unarguably doing a good job. But that use of the image of the soldier whom we dare not criticise provides the linchpin then for what we're going to say about Doonesbury and about the place that cartoon strips play. Roger.
Okay. So once you start looking at examples of how the comics form deals with the war, they're everywhere. And this is just sort of random things. From the war itself, this was a flyer that was dropped on the enemy. This is translated actually by one of Martin's students from the Arabic, using comics. This is a fundamentalist Christian strip by Jack Chick that was distributed among some of the American troops. So they were actually out there. This is a recruitment poster. This is actually about Afghanistan, but this again for the British military, again using the comics form. And then around that you have a variety of other things, graphic novels. I'm sure some of you know these books, some of them very good. And from a variety of political perspectives as well, some of them very liberal, some of them not so. The one on the top left there has been criticized for being rather gung-ho. And of course, editorial strips as well in newspapers, magazines, etc., etc. I won't go through these, but these are just sort of for background. So Doonesbury was part of that, and it went in hard when it came to Iraq. Now this is Gary Trudeau on the left there with one of his Doonesbury strips. On the right, this is probably his most famous character, and this is BD, Brian Dowling. And BD has been there since the start. He's been there since 1968 in the strip. And he's had a number of functions in it. He always wears a helmet of some kind, and this is him in his football coaching helmet, which is how most people came to know him. But he's worn other kinds of helmets as well, so a motorcycling helmet and so on and so forth. He is a Republican. He's a right winger. He's unreconstructed. He cries when President Nixon is impeached, and he's rather sexist, and so on and so forth. But he's also very human, and he's very lovable. And the liberal readers of Doonesbury often cite him as their favourite character. So what happens during Iraq is that he signs up for the military, he gets sent out there, and on a roadside outside Fallujah, this happens to BD. And you can imagine that is quite a shocking moment. You know, people who know Doonesbury as a gag strip, and suddenly they're faced with this. It's quite amazing. You know, people talk about the death of Superman, things like that. No, this is the this is the comics moment. Really shocking stuff. I want to read you very quickly what a fan said when he first saw this, and he said the following. He said, "The only soldier I know who's serving in Iraq is named BD, and yesterday I learned that he'd got his leg blown off. Since the war started, over 3,600 Americans have been wounded in Iraq, but this is the first time it's somebody I know, which changes everything, of course. As they loaded him into the medevac, BD's buddy had to take off his helmet. and for all the decades I've known BD, I've never seen him without his helmet. I never knew he had black hair. So that's one fan's account. So I think in that quote there, you can see that people have made a bond with these characters over years and years, sometimes decades, and then something shocking like this happens, and it's a jolt. This is a strip that dares to engage people emotionally with the war as well as intellectually. So it's quite a powerful statement. I should mention something about the helmet. I mean, it's a symbolic part of BD's personality. If you think of characters like Judge Dredd, it's the same effect. And so without his helmet, he becomes one of us. And it's as one of us that this injury is really brought home. Okay, so here is a strip, as I said, that has this emotional dimension to it, and it's an extremely brave move on Trudeau's part. How does he develop the story? Well, you have the story continues with BD's recovery. He goes to hospital, he has a prosthetic leg fitted, and he has to recover from his psychological damage as well, the whole post-traumatic disorder issue. And he gets counselling, and this character here on the right is in fact a Vietnam veteran who is his counsellor, and we'll hear more about these people in a minute. So these were two books that were collected from the strip. Do you want to hold them up, Martin? That's what they look like. And these were incredibly important books. What's interesting about them as well, I think we should point out, is that they were for charity. They were done for charity. The profits went to an association that provided cheap housing for relatives who were visiting injured troops, the Fisher House organisation. So that's interesting. But what's particularly interesting from our point of view is who's writing the forewords to these books. And I don't know if you can read it on the screen, it gets lost a bit. But the first foreword to the first book is by Senator John McCain, and the second one is by General Richard Myers. Now, these are not people you associate with the political left. You know, these are right-wingers, these are Republicans. Just to remind you about John McCain, there he is. You may have forgotten him. He was a candidate in the recent election. Now, he himself was a war veteran. He was shot down in Vietnam. He was taken prisoner. He was tortured. And he suffered PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. He was a fierce supporter of the Gulf War. He supported the rise in troop numbers throughout the war. He is obviously a right-wing figure. In 1995, he denounced Trudeau and he denounced Doonesbury from the floor of the Senate. And he said the following. He said, suffice it to say that I hold Trudeau in utter contempt. And in fact, what happened was when they collected the Trudeau stories, they put the quote on the cover of the book as a badge of sort of pride. You know, this man hates it so much. But there he is. There he is with these books writing the foreword. So what is going on? I'll read you what he says in the foreword. He says, this is the story of thousands of American soldiers. In this book, Gary Trudeau tells the story, and he does it very well. Biting but never cynical, often wickedly funny, these comic strips will make you laugh, reflect, and in the end, understand. So what a nice foreword he's writing. So what is going on? So after this incident with BD getting injured, it becomes a cause célèbre on the liberal left in America. Some of the old style magazines and media outlets take it on. This is a cover of Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone had been a key publication during the Vietnam War in expressing anti-war sentiment. Again, the sentiment here is supporting the troops but not the war, and that's very important. Supporting the troops, not the war. And this is one of the editors on Rolling Stone sort of echoing what the fan said just now about BD and his helmet. So it becomes a key moment in the anti-war movement, and it allows Trudeau to expand his activism, and he starts a website called The Sandbox, and this is a forum for serving men and women in Iraq and in Afghanistan to write home about the war. It's a military blog, and this little strip explains it a bit better. So he becomes much more active. He ramps up his anti-war feeling and strips, supporting the troops, always supporting the troops. So just to move it on, what kind of liberalism is this? How can there possibly be common ground between what Trudeau is doing and what the right-wingers like McCain and the general who are writing the forewords to his books, what they're thinking? So how can these two things meet? Now, the publishers put out a statement that it's down to charity. You know, they're all working together because these books are for charity. Now, we have another theory. We think it goes deeper than that, and we think it has a lot to do with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, at speed. Let's remind ourselves what a shock it was. When that strip began, nobody expected it. There was no forewarning, no pre-publicity. Suddenly, you had a strip with a black panel at the beginning. You didn't know what was going on. You didn't know who was injured. You had to learn that it was BD. And then they took his helmet off for the first time. And this real sense of shock was very tangible. Lots of people wrote letters about it. There were discussions about it. This was a real challenge. Then follow it. Over 187 panels, Trudeau evolves this story. This is not something he rushes at. In fact, we don't get to this panel here, the taking off the helmet, for another 2 days. So everything is happening very, very slowly with a big build-up. And what is very important is that across the two books that Rogers illustrated, he sections the physical recovery and the psychological recovery. In the whole first book, we are seeing him being misunderstood. And it's very important the way in which he builds the character. First of all, in important ways, there is a stress on BD himself as a very special individual. Here's him coming to terms with the fact he can't remember why he always wore a helmet. No one other than BD could do this. So very, very individualized. Yet at the same time, there was also something about him being a case, a type, almost a stereotype of a misunderstood soldier. So here we have someone who's saying, you know, we get this commentary on the left, there's something about loss of limb that many people find unnerving. And so Beatty becomes an example of people being unnerved by someone having lost a limb. Then we have a very particular way in which he's made into a certain kind of hero. Here's someone visiting him in hospital. Before I go, coach, I'd like to thank you for your sacrifice. Please don't. Don't what? Don't thank me for my sacrifice. Okay. Okay, thanks for getting blown up. Just doing my job. This is the ideal soldier that's now being presented. And this is very important. It's a soldier who is self-denying. So that rolls on for more than 90 strips, him going through physical recovery. Then we come to the period of psychological recovery in the story called The War Within. What happens in this story? We suddenly start hearing that BD is having nightmares, that he's having flashbacks. The nightmares have nothing to do with what he underwent. I'll tell you why I stress that in a moment. Yet the nightmares have nothing to do with what he underwent. He starts being terrified by and hating and wanting to attack everybody who looks faintly Arabic. His daughter becomes scared of him because he shoots up his own garage. His wife hides his gun, and so he keeps a weed whacker by the bed because he's scared he might get attacked. In all kinds of ways, he's showing psychological problems, but he won't go for help until his daughter Sam becomes so scared that he realizes his family is falling apart. He rings back to Iraq and talks to people in Iraq, as in this set here. And then he starts talking on the phone to people who might counsel him and give him advice. But he can't go. And eventually, after trying out various things, he scouts out and he visits a vet center where he meets that Vietnam vet. And that's really important because Vietnam now starts playing a recovery role in the story. We go through nearly 100 sets before we get to the point of discovering what his problem was. Before that, we have him misunderstanding himself. So in this set here, this is the Vietnam vet. See, bro, sometimes combat comes at you so hard, the memories don't get processed properly. For instance, the day you got hit in Fallujah, what's your toughest memory? Losing my helmet. What's the gag at the end of it? That would be the day you lost your leg. I knew you wouldn't understand. And this is about BD showing his own conflicts and weaknesses. But what emerges... Oh, sorry, I'll skip this for time reasons. What emerges right at the end is really fascinating. Right in the last three sets, it's revealed that he's had a secret in his head that he can't admit to himself. In charge of a patrol, forbidden to stop when out on patrol, he gets caught up in a firefight and tells his driver to gun it. They go straight ploughing into a crowd of civilians, and the information, though it's not told directly, the implication is they kill civilians. Now, it's a very, very odd setup where this happens, because apparently, with gunfire going away 10, 20 yards away, these civilians are casually shopping in the street. They're paying no attention. He guns straight into them. What does the Vietnam vet, his therapist, say? So your driver gunned it through the crowd. On my order. It was my decision. Yes, it was your decision, BD, but it wasn't a choice. Making sure your guys survive isn't a choice. It's a duty. Nobody could have asked more of you. That's a fact, bro. And he's cured. And that's weird. Because all the way through the story, the implication has been that all this suffering is evidence of him suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, what is post-traumatic stress disorder? And here we have to get contentious. People present it as though it is a known disease. In fact, it's a very recently known disease because it was invented, I use the word deliberately, in 1980 as a category. There's a document in America called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. First version came out shortly after the Second World War. It's been revised several times. DSM-3 came out in 1980, and PTSD was in there for the very first time. And it was constructed as a compromise, because in every other case in that document, diseases were not going to be defined any longer by causes. They were only going to be known by symptoms. PTSD was made an exception. Suffering from gross, unexpected stress causes PTSD. And it was welcomed. It was welcomed because it made people feel good about themselves. It was the only condition, neurosis, psychosis, schizophrenia, all these other things, dissociation, those you don't want to have, PTSD, that's not bad, because I can get treatment for that, and I suddenly become a little bit heroic. I am the victim. The kind of range of things that you can have it for, being caught up in 9/11, watching people being caught up in 9/11, hearing the news about 9/11, child being scared by a horror movie, or, and most interestingly, killing someone and feeling very, very guilty about it. Now, I want very quickly, because we're running short of time, to circle back to those films. I said I wanted to talk briefly about one film, because it illustrates something really important about that fact-fiction thing going on here. And the film is In the Valley of Elah. I don't know if any of you have seen it. It's a very, very well-made film, and I recommend it as film, but it has a problem. It tells the story of an elderly man, Vietnam vet, interesting, whose son has gone to Iraq and then goes AWOL. He's come back to America and he's vanished, and his father goes to try to find him. Father played by Tommy Lee Jones, brilliantly played, really brilliantly played. Can't find his son, and the military are being very hush-hush about it. Eventually, his son turns up, dead. Not only dead, but cut up and his body burnt in parts. This looks nasty. And at first they think it's drugs. He got caught up in the drugs trade. But his dad finds that hard to believe. That doesn't sound like his son. So with the help of one local policewoman, they dig, they investigate, and they uncover the story. And the story that emerges is, lo and behold, he was killed by his platoon mates who'd come back from Iraq, and they were all suffering from PTSD, and they were all affectless. And so a minor conflict, a minor squabble became a vicious row. He got killed. They killed him, went off and bought chicken wings. And the story ends then with it being discovered that this son had tortured Iraqis. But by this time, we're so much on his side that torturing Iraqis, well, of course, when you're stressed, you just do something like that, don't you? The interesting thing is there is a real story behind this film. The story of a man called Richard T. Davis, who did go to Iraq, who did come back from Iraq, who was butchered by his platoon mates. And the man who wrote the script for this, uncovered the story of it, wrote the script for the film. But the story he tells for real is different. That probably the explanation for the killing wasn't PTSD at all. The story was that Richard Davis was about to rat on his mates for raping an Iraqi woman. Fictionalizing it, turning it into something which is proper for use in the public domain, we attribute post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's the argument Roger and I want to make. If you want one other example, this is the one bit that we didn't do in Manchester. So here's something new for those of you who heard us give this in Manchester. Do you remember the case that came up in Britain a few months ago of the guy who'd worked undercover from the police in various peace movements, in various anti-nuclear movements, etc.? And eventually he was unmasked and various people were released from prison and their cases against them collapsed because his evidence had been suppressed. This is the man. A six-duck police officer was unmasked as an undercover spy in the protest movement last night, as it emerged that Mark Kennedy, who spent 7 years posing as an environmental activist, is considering suing Scotland Yard. This is the policeman suing Scotland Yard. What is he suing them for? Post-traumatic stress disorder. And the argument I want to make is that PTSD was designed to depoliticize the situation of soldiers. Yes, soldiers do suffer, no question. But PTSD represents it as though the military here are the victims. And that is a real problem. I'll hand back to Roger to draw things together.
Okay, so I've got some figures here just to give our discussion some perspective. Estimates vary, but the Iraq war has so far left around 1 million dead Iraqis. The vast majority of those are civilians, and 4,474 dead Americans as of yesterday. The Vietnam War was much bigger, resulted in around 3 million dead Vietnamese, again, vast majority civilians, and 58,000 American dead. Now, the anti-war fictional narratives about both wars tell a necessarily and understandably partial story, but in their partiality, they are ideological. If you tell a tale about one depressed American, there's naturally going to be a danger of reducing the war to, quote, an American tragedy, which is exactly what happened to the majority of the Vietnam stories, as we've seen. Now, this is about installing a myth to reconcile Americans to what has happened. Now, in other words, for any storyline to revolve around an implicit acceptance of PTSD, whether that storyline be a comic strip or any other number of Iraq/Afghanistan/Vietnam narratives, is to risk condoning the ideological work that term insists upon. In the case of BD's story, it takes the emphasis away from a critique of why he was in Iraq, how the war might be justified, and the grotesque level of civilian casualties, which is fictionally referenced in the way that he gets hurt. Instead, the reader is asked to accept that he suffered, quote, seriously non-normal stress, end quote, while just doing his job, that he is, quote, a hero because of it, and that the PTSD industry is a valid one. These are political inferences, which brings us back to John McCain. And very quickly, by endorsing the strip, McCain did four things. First, he showed he had an empathy for pop culture, and indeed when it came to the comedy aspects of Doonesbury, that he could take a joke, and that's of course very important to any politician's profile, especially if you've got eyes on the White House. Secondly, McCain was aligning himself with a military that was generally sympathetic to the strip. Third, the Doonesbury book was a story about a veteran, and there was obviously going to be an element of self-validation for McCain. BD was pulling through from his injuries, just as McCain had pulled through from his. It was an inspiring story, and McCain could be part of it by proxy. But fourth, by associating himself with a story about the recovery of veterans, or moreover veterans with PTSD, McCain was making another political point, namely that their suffering transcended any questioning of the whys and wherefores of the war. Now, we're not saying that Gary Trudeau is a secret conservative. I mean, I hope you can see we admire his work greatly. And we're not saying that people don't get traumatized in wartime, of course not. What we are saying is that PTSD is a problematic category. The narratives constructed around it cause us to think about behavior in wartime in particular ways. And that is where myths begin and where Doonesbury's liberalism gets compromised. Thank you very much.
If you'd like to find out more information about the Imperial War Museum, please go to www.iwm.org.uk. Martin Baker's book, A Toxic Genre, about the Iraq War in American cinema, is available now from all good bookshops. You can find more information about Doonesbury at www.doonesbury.com. That's DONESBURY.com. And the two books which featured the depiction of BD's experiences following the Iraq War can be found in all good comic shops and are available online. Panel Borders will be back at the same time next week, continuing our month-long look at war comics with another interview or panel discussion from the Imperial War Museum's conference. If you've enjoyed listening to Panel Borders every Thursday at 5 on Resonance FM, then please note that Panel Borders will be moving to a new day and time at the beginning of October. So next week, Thursday the 15th of September, is the penultimate episode of Panel Borders in its current slot. From Sunday the 2nd of October, Panel Borders will be on every Sunday evening at 7:30 p.m. Podcasts of every episode will continue to be available on my blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Roger Sabin and Martin Baker's presentation was recorded by Steve Clark, and the interviews about Draw Your Weapons at the National Army Museum were recorded, introduced, and edited by Alex Fitch. Thanks for listening.